7, and he rebelled against his immigrant family by being cool, hanging around the pool hall, and adopting a James Dean leather-jacketed swagger. Namath's football talents were flamboyantly obvious. He was one of the most highly recruited players in the country that year. He wanted to go to college in Maryland, thinking it was in the South, but his SATs weren't high enough. So he went to the University of Alabama, where he went on to become one of the nation's best collegiate quarterbacks. He was given a gigantic signing bonus to play with the New York Jets, and was immediately making much more than any of his teammates. He cultivated a personal brand that was bigger than the team. He was not just a football star, but a lifestyle star. He paid a fine so he could wear a Fu Manchu mustache on the field. He starred in pantyhose commercials, challenging old-fashioned notions of masculinity. He famously had 6-inch shag carpets in his bachelor pad, and he popularized the use of the word foxes for women. He wrote an autobiography titled, "I Can't Wait Until Tomorrow, 'Cause I Get Better Looking Every Day." This is not a title Johnny Unitas would have chosen. Namath came to stardom at a time when new journalism was breaking the mold of the old reporting. Namath was the perfect subject. Without a reticent bone in his body, he'd bring reporters along as he worked his way through bottles of scotch the night before games. He openly bragged about what a great athlete he was, how good-looking he was. He cultivated a brashly honest style. "Joe, Joe, you're the most beautiful thing in the world," he shouted to himself in the bathroom mirror of the Copacabana one night in 1966, as a reporter from the Saturday Evening Post tagged along. Fiercely independent, he did not want to make a deep commitment to any woman. He created an early version of what we would now call the hookup culture. "I don't like to date so much as I just like to kind of, you know, run into something, man," he told a reporter for Sports Illustrated in 1966. He embodied the autonomy ethos that was beginning to sweep through the country. "I believe in letting a guy live the way he wants to, if he doesn't hurt anyone. I feel that everything I do is okay for me and doesn't affect anybody else, including the girls I go out with. Look, man, I live and let live. I like everybody." Namath heralded a new mode for being a professional athlete, a mode of personal branding, lavish endorsements, in which the star expressed his own vibrant personality and outshone the team. Cultural change. Cultures change in ways that are both superficial and profound. When the essayist Joseph Epstein was young, he observed that when you went into the drugstore, the cigarettes were in the open shelves and the condoms were behind the counter. But now, when you go to the drugstore, the condoms are in the open shelves and the cigarettes are behind the counter. The conventional view of the shift from the humility of Unitas to the brash flamboyance of Namath is that it happened in the late 1960s. The conventional story goes something like this. First, there was the Greatest Generation, whose members were self-sacrificing, self-effacing, and community-minded. Then along came the 1960s and the baby boomers, who were narcissistic, self-expressive, selfish, and morally lax. But this story doesn't fit the facts. What really happened goes like this. Starting in biblical times, there was a tradition of moral realism, the crooked timber school of humanity. This tradition, or worldview, put tremendous emphasis on sin and human weakness. This view of humanity was captured in the figure of Moses, the meekest of men, who nonetheless led a people, and by biblical figures like David, who were great heroes, but deeply flawed. This biblical metaphysic was later expressed by Christian thinkers such as Augustine, with his emphasis on sin, his rejection of worldly success, his belief in the necessity of grace, of surrendering oneself to God's unmerited love. This moral realism then found expression in humanists like Samuel Johnson, Michel de Montaigne, and George Eliot, who emphasized how little we can know, how hard it is to know ourselves, and how hard we have to work on the long road to virtue. We are all of us born in moral stupidity, taking the world as an udder to feed our supreme selves, Eliot wrote. It was also embodied in different ways and at different times in the thought of Dante, Hume, Burke, Reinhold Niebuhr, and Isaiah Berlin. All of these thinkers take a limited view of our individual powers of reason. They are suspicious of abstract thinking and pride. They emphasize the limitations in our individual natures. Some of these limitations are epistemological. Reason is weak, and the world is complex. We cannot really grasp the complexity of the world or the full truth about ourselves. Some of these limitations are moral. There are bugs in our souls that lead us toward selfishness and pride, that tempt us to put lower loves over higher loves. Some of the limitations are psychological. We are divided within ourselves, and many of the most urgent motions of our minds are unconscious and only dimly recognized by ourselves. Some of them are social. We are not self-completing creatures. To thrive, we have to throw ourselves into a state of dependence on others, on institutions, on the divine. The place that limitation occupies in the crooked timber school is immense. Around the 18th century, moral realism found a rival in moral romanticism. While moral realists placed emphasis on inner weakness, moral romantics like Jean-Jacques Rousseau placed emphasis on our inner goodness. The realists distrusted the self and trusted institutions and customs outside the self. The romantics trusted the self and distrusted the conventions of the outer world. The realists believed in cultivation, civilization, and artifice. The romanticists believed in nature, the individual, and sincerity. For a while, these two traditions lived side by side in society, in creative tension and conversation. Except in artistic circles, realism had the upper hand. If you grew up in early 20th century America, you grew up with the vocabulary and categories of moral realism, translated into a practical, secular, or religious idiom. Perkins grew up with the vocabulary of vocation, the need to suppress parts of yourself so you can be an instrument in a larger cause. Eisenhower grew up with the vocabulary of self-defeat. Day learned as a young woman the vocabulary of simplicity, poverty, and surrender. Marshall learned institutional thinking, the need to give oneself to organizations that transcend a lifetime. Randolph and Rustin learned reticence and the logic of self-discipline, the need to distrust oneself even while waging a noble crusade. These people didn't know they were exemplifying parts of the realist tradition. This ethos was just in the air they breathed and the way they were raised. But then moral realism collapsed. Its vocabulary and ways of thinking were forgotten or shoved off into the margins of society. Realism and romanticism slipped out of balance. A moral vocabulary was lost, and along with it a methodology for the formation of souls. This shift did not happen during the 1960s and 1970s, though that period was a great romantic flowering. It happened earlier, in the late 1940s and 1950s. It was the greatest generation that abandoned realism. By the fall of 1945, people around the world had endured 16 years of deprivation, first during the Depression, then during the war. They were ready to let loose, to relax, to enjoy. Consumption and advertising took off as people rushed to the stores to buy things that would make life easier and more fun. People in the post-war years wanted to escape from the shackles of self-restraint and all those gloomy subjects like sin and depravity. They were ready to put the horrors of the Holocaust and the war behind them. People right after the war were ready to read any book that offered a more upbeat and positive vision of life and its possibilities. In 1946, Rabbi Joshua L. Liebman published a book titled Peace of Mind, that urged people to engrave a new morality on their hearts, one based on setting aside the idea that you should repress any part of yourself. Instead, thou shalt love thyself properly. Thou shalt not be afraid of thy hidden impulses. Respect thyself. Trust thyself. Liebman had an infinite faith in the infinite goodness of men and women. I believe that man is infinitely potential, and that given the proper guidance, there is hardly a task he cannot perform or a degree of mastery in work and love he cannot attain. He struck a chord. His book remained on the top of the New York Times bestseller list for an astounding 58 weeks. That same year, Benjamin Spock came out with his famous baby book. That book was complex and is often unfairly maligned, but it did, especially in early editions, express a notably rosy view of human nature. Spock said that if your child steals something, you should give him as a present something similar to the item that he stole. That will show that you care for your child and that he should have his heart's desire if it is reasonable. In 1949, Harry Overstreet published a wildly popular book titled The Mature Mind, which pushed the point a little further. Overstreet argued that those like St. Augustine, who emphasized human sinfulness, had denied to our species the healthy blessing of self-respect. This emphasis on internal weakness encouraged people to distrust himself and malign himself. Then in 1952, Norman Vincent Peale came out with the mother of all optimistic books, The Power of Positive Thinking, urging readers to cast negative thoughts from mind and pep-talk themselves into greatness. That book rested atop the Times list for an astounding 98 weeks. Then came humanistic psychology led by people like Carl Rogers, the most influential psychologist of the 20th century. The humanistic psychologists shifted away from Freud's darker conception of the unconscious and promoted a sky-high estimation of human nature. The primary psychological problem, he argued, is that people don't love themselves enough, and so therapists unleashed a great wave of self-loving. Man's behavior is exquisitely rational, Rogers wrote, moving with subtle and ordered complexity toward the goal his organism is endeavoring to achieve. The words that best describe human nature, he continued, are positive, forward-moving, constructive, realistic, and trustworthy. People don't need to combat themselves. They only need to open up, to liberate their inner selves, so that their internalized drive to self-actualize can take over. Self-love, self-praise, and self-acceptance are the paths to happiness. To the extent that a person can be freely in touch with his valuing process in himself, he will behave in ways that are self-enhancing. Humanistic psychology has shaped nearly every school, nearly every curriculum, nearly every HR department, nearly every self-help book. Soon there were IALAC posters on school walls everywhere. I am lovable and capable. The self-esteem movement was born. Our modern conversation lives in this romantic vision. The Age of Self-Esteem. The shift from one moral culture to another is not a crude story of decline, from noble restraint to self-indulgent decadence. Each moral climate is a collective response to the problems of the moment. People in the Victorian era were faced with a decline in religious faith and adopted a strict character morality as a way to compensate. People in the 1950s and 1960s confronted a different set of problems. When people shift from one moral ecology to another, they are making a trade-off in response to changing circumstances. Since legitimate truths sit in tension with one another, one moral climate will put more emphasis here and less emphasis there, for better or worse. Certain virtues are cultivated, certain beliefs go too far, and certain important truths and moral virtues are accidentally forgotten. The shift in the 1950s and 1960s to a culture that put more emphasis on pride and self-esteem had many positive effects. It helped correct some deep social injustices. Up until those years, many social groups, notably women, minorities, and the poor, had received messages of inferiority and humiliation. They were taught to think too lowly of themselves. The culture of self-esteem encouraged members of these oppressed groups to believe in themselves, to raise their sights and aspirations. For example, many women had been taught to lead lives so committed to subservience and service that it led to self-abnegation. Catherine Meyer Graham's life illustrates why so many people embraced the shift from self-effacement to self-expression. Catherine Meyer grew up in a wealthy publishing family in Washington, D.C. She attended the Madeira School, a progressive but genteel private school in which young ladies were raised amid mottos such as "Function in disaster, finish in style." At home, she was thoroughly dominated by a father who was awkward and distant, and by a mother who demanded Stepford wife perfection. I think we all felt we somehow hadn't lived up to what she expected or wanted of us, and the insecurities and lack of self-confidence she bred were long-lasting, she would write years later in her superb memoir. Girls were expected to be quiet, reserved, and correct, and Catherine grew up painfully self-conscious. Had I said the right thing? Had I worn the right clothes? Was I attractive? These questions were unsettling and self-absorbing, even overwhelming at times. In 1940, Catherine married a charming, witty, mercurial man named Philip Graham, who had a subtle or not-so-subtle way of belittling her views and abilities. I increasingly saw my role as the tail to his kite, and the more I felt overshadowed, the more it became a reality. Graham had a series of affairs which Catherine discovered and was devastated by. Graham, who suffered from depression, committed suicide on August 3, 1963. 6 weeks later, Catherine was elected president of the Washington Post Company. At first, she saw herself as a bridge between her dead husband and her children, who would eventually inherit it. But she shut her eyes, took a step as manager, took another step, and found she could do the job. Over the next few decades, the surrounding culture encouraged Catherine to assert herself and to develop the full use of her capacities. The year she took over the post, Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique, which embraced Carl Rogers's humanistic psychology. Gloria Steinem later wrote a best-selling book, Revolution from Within, a book of self-esteem. Dr. Joyce Brothers, a prominent advice columnist at the time, put the ethos bluntly, put yourself first, at least some of the time. Society has brainwashed women into believing that their husbands' and children's needs should always be given priority over their own. Society has never impressed on women, as it has on men, the human necessity of putting yourself first. I am not advocating selfishness. I'm talking about the basics of life. You have to decide how many children you want, what kind of friends you want, what kind of relationships you want with your family. The emphasis on self-actualization and self-esteem gave millions of women a language to articulate and cultivate self-assertion, strength, and identity. Graham eventually became one of the most admired and powerful publishing executives in the world. She built the Post into a major and highly profitable national newspaper. She stood up to the Nixon White House and storm of abuse during the Watergate crisis, maintaining steadfast support for Bob Woodward, Carl Bernstein, and the rest of the journalists who broke that story. She never fully overcame her insecurities, but she did learn to project a formidable image. Her memoir is a masterwork, understated but also honest and authoritative, without a hint of self-pity or false sentiment. Catherine Graham, like many women and members of minority groups, needed a higher and more accurate self-image, needed to move from little me to big me. Authenticity. The underlying assumptions about human nature and the shape of human life were altered by this shift to the big me. If you were born at any time over the last 60 years, you were probably born into what the philosopher Charles Taylor has called the culture of authenticity. This mindset is based on the romantic idea that each of us has a golden figure in the core of ourself. There is an innately good, true self which can be trusted, consulted, and gotten in touch with. Your personal feelings are the best guide for what is right and wrong. In this ethos, the self is to be trusted, not doubted. Your desires are like inner oracles for what is right and true. You know you are doing the right thing when you feel good inside. The valid rules of life are those you make or accept for yourself and that feel right to you. Our moral salvation, Taylor writes, describing this culture, comes from recovering authentic moral contact with ourselves. It is important to stay true to that pure inner voice and not follow the conformities of a corrupting world. As Taylor puts it, "There is a certain way of being that is my way. I am called to live my life in this way and not in imitation of anyone else's. If I am not, I miss the point of my life. I miss what being human is for me." From an older tradition of self-combat, we move to self-liberation and self-expression. Moral authority is no longer found in some external objective good. It is found in each person's unique original self. Greater emphasis is put on personal feelings as a guide to what is right and wrong. I know I am doing right because I feel harmonious inside. Something is going wrong, on the other hand, when I feel my autonomy is being threatened, when I feel I am not being true to myself. In this ethos, sin is not found in your individual self. It is found in the external structures of society, in racism, inequality, and oppression. To improve yourself, you have to be taught to love yourself, to be true to yourself, not to doubt yourself and struggle against yourself. As one of the characters in one of the high school musical movies sings, "The answers are all inside of me. All I've got to do is believe." Status updates. This intellectual and cultural shift toward the big me was reinforced by economic and technological changes. All of us today live in a technological culture. I'm not a big believer that social media have had a ruinous effect on the culture, as many technophobes fear. There is no evidence to support the idea that technology has induced people to live in a fake online world while renouncing the real one. But information technology has had three effects on the moral ecology that have inflated the big me Adam 1 side of our natures and diminished the humbler Adam 2. First, communications have become faster and busier. It is harder to attend to the soft, still voices that come from the depths. Throughout human history, people have found that they are most aware of their depths when they are on retreats, during moments of separation and stillness, during moments of quiet communion. They have found that they need time, long periods of stillness, before the external Adam quiets and the internal Adam can be heard. These moments of stillness and quiet are just more rare today. We reach for the smartphone. Second, social media allow a more self-referential information environment. People have more tools and occasions to construct a culture, a mental environment tailored specifically for themselves. Modern information technology allows families to sit together in a room, each absorbed in a different show, movie, or game in the privacy of their own screen. Instead of being a peripheral star in the mass media world of the Ed Sullivan Show, each individual can be the sun at the center of his or her own media solar system, creating a network of programs, apps, and pages oriented around their own needs. A Yahoo advertising campaign vowed, "Now the internet has a personality. It's you." Earthlink's slogan was, "Earthlink revolves around you." Third, social media encourages a broadcasting personality. Our natural bent is to seek social approval and fear exclusion. Social networking technology allows us to spend our time engaged in a hyper-competitive struggle for attention, for victories in the currency of likes. People are given more occasions to be self-promoters, to embrace the characteristics of celebrity, to manage their own image, to Snapchat out their selfies in ways that they hope will impress and please the world. This technology creates a culture in which people turn into little brand managers using Facebook, Twitter, text messages, and Instagram to create a falsely upbeat, slightly over-exuberant external self that can be famous first in a small sphere, and then, with luck, in a large one. The manager of this self measures success by the flow of responses it gets. The social media maven spends his or her time creating a self-caricature, a much happier and more photogenic version of real life. People subtly start comparing themselves to other people's highlight reels, and of course, they feel inferior. The soul of man under meritocracy. The purification of the meritocracy has also reinforced the idea that each of us is wonderful inside. It has also encouraged self-aggrandizing tendencies. If you have lived through the last 60 or 70 years, you are the product of a more competitive meritocracy. You have, like me, spent your life trying to make something of yourself, trying to have an impact, trying to be reasonably successful in this world. That's meant a lot of competition and a lot of emphasis on individual achievement, doing reasonably well in school, getting into the right college, landing the right job, moving towards success and status. This competitive pressure meant that we all have to spend more time, energy, and attention on the external Adam 1 climb towards success, and we have less time, energy, and attention to devote to the internal world of Adam 2. I've found in myself, and I think I've observed in others, a certain meritocratic mentality, which is based on the self-trusting, self-puffing insights of the Romantic tradition, but which is also depoeticized and despiritualized. If moral realists saw the self as a wilderness to be tamed, and if people in the New Age 1970s saw the self as an Eden to be actualized, people living in a high-pressure meritocracy are more likely to see the self as a resource base to be cultivated. The self is less likely to be seen as the seat of the soul, or as the repository of some transcendent spirit. Instead, the self is a vessel of human capital. It is a series of talents to be cultivated efficiently and prudently. The self is defined by its tasks and accomplishments. The self is about talent, not character. This meritocratic mentality was beautifully captured in Dr. Seuss's 1990 book, Oh, the Places You'll Go, the fifth biggest bestseller in the history of the New York Times list, and still a popular graduation present. The book is about a boy who is reminded that he has all these amazing talents and gifts and ultimate freedom to choose his life. You have brains in your head, you have feet in your shoes. You can steer yourself any direction you choose. The boy is reminded that his life is about fulfilling his own desires. You're on your own, and you know what you know, and you are the guy who'll decide where to go. The challenges the boy faces in life are mostly external, and the life goals he pursues are all Adam 1 life goals. Fame, you'll be famous as famous can be, with the whole wide world watching you win on TV. The ultimate goal in this life is success, to have an impact on the external world. And will you succeed? Yes, you will indeed, 98.75% guaranteed. And the main character in this success story is you. That little word appears in this very short book 90 times. In this book, the boy is completely autonomous. He is free to choose exactly as he individually wishes. He is reminded how wonderful he is. He is not weighted down by any internal weakness. He proves his merit through work and ascent. The meritocracy liberates enormous energies and ranks people in ways good and bad. But it also has a subtle effect on character, culture, and values. Any hyper-competitive system built upon merit is going to encourage people to think a lot about themselves and the cultivation of their own skills. Work becomes the defining feature of a life, especially as you begin to get social invitations because you happen to inhabit a certain job. Subtly, softly but pervasively, this system instills a certain utilitarian calculus in us all. The meritocracy subtly encourages an instrumental ethos in which each occasion, a party, a dinner, and each acquaintance becomes an opportunity to advance your status and professional life project. People are more likely to think in commercial categories, to speak about opportunity costs, scalability, human capital, cost-benefit analysis, even when it comes to how they spend their private time. The meaning of the word character changes. It is used less to describe traits like selflessness, generosity, self-sacrifice, and other qualities that sometimes make worldly success less likely. It is instead used to describe traits like self-control, grit, resilience, and tenacity, qualities that make worldly success more likely. The meritocratic system wants you to be big about yourself, to puff yourself, to be completely sure of yourself, to believe that you deserve a lot and to get what you think you deserve, so long as it is good. The meritocracy wants you to assert and advertise yourself. It wants you to display and exaggerate your achievements. The achievement machine rewards you if you can demonstrate superiority. If, with 1,000 little gestures, conversational types, and styles of dress, you can demonstrate that you are a bit smarter, hipper, more accomplished, sophisticated, famous, plugged in, and fashion-forward than the people around you. It encourages narrowing. It encourages you to become a shrewd animal. The shrewd animal has streamlined his inner humanity to make his ascent more aerodynamic. He carefully manages his time and his emotional commitments. Things once done in a poetic frame of mind, such as going to college, meeting a potential lover, or bonding with an employer, are now done in a more professional frame of mind. Is this person, opportunity, or experience of use to me? There just isn't time to get carried away by love and passion. There is a cost to making a soul-deep commitment to one mission or one love. If you commit to one big thing, you will close off options toward other big things. You will be plagued by a fear of missing out. The shift from the little me culture to the big me culture was not illegitimate, but it went too far. The realist tradition that emphasized limitation and moral struggle was inadvertently marginalized and left by the side of the road, first by the romantic flowering of positive psychology, then by the self-branding ethos of social media, finally by the competitive pressures of the meritocracy. We are left with a moral ecology that builds up the exterior Adam 1 muscles but ignores the internal Adam 2 ones, and that creates an imbalance. It's a culture in which people are defined by their external abilities and achievements, in which a cult of busyness develops as everybody frantically tells each other how overcommitted they are. As my student Andrew Reeves once put it, it cultivates an unrealistic expectation that life will happen on a linear progression, a natural upward slope toward success. It encourages people to satisfice, to get by on talent, and just enough commitment to get the job done on time, without full soul commitment to any task. This tradition tells you how to do the things that will propel you to the top, but it doesn't encourage you to ask yourself why you are doing them. It offers little guidance on how to choose among different career paths and different vocations, how to determine which will be morally highest and best. It encourages people to become approval-seeking machines, to measure their lives by external praise. If people like you and accord you status, then you must be doing something right. The meritocracy contains its own cultural contradictions. It encourages people to make the most of their capacities. But it leads to the shriveling of the moral faculties that are necessary if you are going to figure out how to point your life in a meaningful direction. Conditional love. Let me just describe one way the meritocracy's utilitarian instrumentalist mindset can, in some cases, distort a sacred bond. Parenthood. There are two great defining features of child-rearing today. First, children are now praised to an unprecedented degree. Dorothy Parker quipped that American children aren't raised, they are incited. They are given food, shelter, and applause. That's much more true today. Children are incessantly told how special they are. In 1966, only about 19% of high school students graduated with an A or A-minus average. By 2013, 53% of students graduated with that average, according to UCLA surveys of incoming college freshmen. Young people are surrounded by so much praise that they develop sky-high aspirations for themselves. According to an Ernst & Young survey, 65% of college students expect to become millionaires. The second defining feature is that children are honed to an unprecedented degree. Parents, at least in the more educated affluent classes, spend much more time than in past generations grooming their children, investing in their skills, and driving them to practices and rehearsals. As Richard Murnane of Harvard found, parents with college degrees invest $5,700 more per year per child on out-of-school enrichment activities than they did in 1978. These two great trends, greater praise and greater honing, combine in interesting ways. Children are bathed in love, but it is often directional love. Parents shower their kids with affection, but it is not simple affection. It is meritocratic affection. It is intermingled with a desire to help their children achieve worldly success. Some parents unconsciously shape their expressions of love to steer their children toward behavior they think will lead to achievement and happiness. Parents glow with extra fervor when their child studies hard, practices hard, wins first place, gets into a prestigious college, or joins the honor society. In today's schools, the word honor means earning top grades. Parental love becomes merit-based. It is not simply, I love you. It is, I love you when you stay on my balance beam. I shower you with praise and care when you're on my beam. Parents in the 1950s were much more likely to say they expected their children to be obedient than parents today, who tell pollsters they want their children to think for themselves. But this desire for obedience hasn't vanished. It's just gone underground. From the straightforward system of rules and lectures, reward and punishment, to the semi-hidden world of approval or disapproval. Lurking in the shadows of merit-based love is the possibility that it may be withdrawn if the child disappoints. Parents would deny this, but the wolf of conditional love is lurking here. This shadowy presence of conditional love produces fear, the fear that there is no utterly safe love. There is no completely secure place where young people can be utterly honest and themselves. On the one hand, relationships between parents and children may be closer than ever before. Parents and children, even college-age children, communicate constantly. With only quiet qualms, young people have accepted the vast achievement system that surrounds them. They submit to it because they long for the approval they get from the adults they love. But the whole situation is more fraught than it appears at first glance. Some children assume that this merit-tangled love is the natural order of the universe. The tiny blips of approval and disapproval are built into the fabric of communication so deep that it is below the level of awareness. Enormous internal pressure is generated by the growing assumption that it is necessary to behave in a certain way to be worthy of another's love. Underneath, the children are terrified that the deepest relationship they know will be lost. Some parents unconsciously regard their children as something like an art project to be crafted through mental and emotional engineering. There is some parental narcissism here, the insistence that your children go to colleges and lead lives that will give the parents status and pleasure. Children who are uncertain of their parents' love develop a voracious hunger for it. This conditional love is like acid that dissolves children's internal criteria, their capacity to make their own decisions about their own interests, careers, marriages, and life in general. The parental relationship is supposed to be built upon unconditional love, a gift that cannot be bought and cannot be earned. It sits outside the logic of meritocracy and is the closest humans come to grace. But in these cases, the pressure to succeed in the Adam One world, has infected a relationship that should be operating by a different logic, the moral logic of Adam Two. The result is holes in the hearts of many children across this society. The age of the selfie. This cultural, technological, and meritocratic environment hasn't made us a race of depraved barbarians, but it has made us less morally articulate. Many of us have instincts about right and wrong, about how goodness and character are built, but everything is fuzzy. Many of us have no clear idea how to build character, no rigorous way to think about such things. We are clear about external, professional things, but unclear about internal, moral ones. What the Victorians were to sex, we are to morality. Everything is covered in euphemism. This shift in culture has changed us. In the first place, it has made us a bit more materialistic. College students now say they put more value on money and career success. Every year, researchers from UCLA survey a nationwide sample of college freshmen to gauge their values and what they want out of life. In 1966, 80% of freshmen said that they were strongly motivated to develop a meaningful philosophy of life. Today, less than half of them say that. In 1966, 42% said that becoming rich was an important life goal. By 1990, 74% agreed with that statement. Financial security, once seen as a middling value, is now tied as students' top goal. In 1966, in other words, students felt it was important to at least present themselves as philosophical and meaning-driven people. By 1990, they no longer felt the need to present themselves that way. They felt it perfectly acceptable to say they were primarily interested in money. We live in a more individualistic society. If you humbly believe that you are not individually strong enough to defeat your own weaknesses, then you know you must be dependent on redemptive assistance from outside. But if you proudly believe the truest answers can be found in the real you, the voice inside, then you are less likely to become engaged with others. Sure enough, there has been a steady decline in intimacy. Decades ago, people typically told pollsters that they had 4 or 5 close friends, people to whom they could tell everything. Now the common answer is 2 or 3, and the number of people with no confidants has doubled. 35% of older adults report being chronically lonely, up from 20% a decade ago. At the same time, social trust has declined. Surveys ask, generally speaking, would you say that most people can be trusted or that you can't be too careful in dealing with people? In the early 1960s, significant majorities said that people can generally be trusted, but in the 1990s, the distrusters had a 20 percentage point margin over the trusters, and those margins have increased in the years since. People have become less empathetic, or at least they display less empathy in how they describe themselves. A University of Michigan study found that today's college students score 40% lower than their predecessors in the 1970s in their ability to understand what another person is feeling. The biggest drop came in the years after 2000. Public language has also become demoralized. Google engrams measure word usage across media. Google scans the contents of books and publications going back decades. You can type in a word and see, over the years, which words have been used more frequently and which less frequently. Over the past few decades, there has been a sharp rise in the usage of individualist words and phrases like self and personalized. I come first and I can do it myself. And a sharp decline in community words like community, share, united, and common good. The use of words having to do with economics and business has increased. While the language of morality and character building is in decline, usage of words like character, conscience, and virtue all declined over the course of the 20th century. Usage of the word bravery has declined by 66% over the course of the 20th century. Gratitude is down 49%, humbleness is down 52%, and kindness is down 56%. This dwindling of the Adam II lexicon has further contributed to moral inarticulateness. In this age of moral autonomy, each individual is told to come up with his or her own worldview. If your name is Aristotle, maybe you can do that. But if it isn't, you probably can't. For his 2011 book, Lost in Transition, Christian Smith of Notre Dame studied the moral lives of American college students. He asked them to describe a moral dilemma they had recently faced. Two-thirds of the young people either couldn't describe a moral problem or described problems that are not moral at all. For example, one said his most recent moral dilemma arose when he pulled into a parking space and didn't have enough quarters for the meter. Not many of them have previously given much or any thought to many of the kinds of questions about morality that we asked, Smith and his co-authors wrote. They didn't understand that a moral dilemma arises when two legitimate moral values clash. Their default position was that moral choices are just a question of what feels right inside, whether it arouses a comfortable emotion. One student uttered this typical response, "I mean, I guess what makes something right is how I feel about it. But different people feel different ways, so I couldn't speak on behalf of anyone else as to what's right and wrong." If you believe that the ultimate oracle is the true self inside, then of course you become emotivist. You make moral judgments on the basis of the feelings that burble up. Of course you become a relativist. One true self has no basis to judge or argue with another true self. Of course you become an individualist, since the ultimate arbiter is the authentic self within and not any community standard or external horizon of significance without. Of course you lose contact with the moral vocabulary that is needed to think about these questions. Of course the inner life becomes more level. Instead of inspiring peaks and despairing abysses, ethical decision-making is just gentle rolling foothills, nothing to get too hepped up about. The mental space that was once occupied by moral struggle has gradually become occupied by the struggle to achieve. Morality has been displaced by utility. Adam II has been displaced by Adam I. The Wrong Life. In 1886, Leo Tolstoy published his famous novella, The Death of Ivan Ilyich. The central character is a successful lawyer and magistrate who one day is hanging curtains in his fancy new house when he falls awkwardly on his side. He thinks nothing of it at first, but then he develops an odd taste in his mouth and grows ill. Eventually, he realizes that at age 45, he is dying. Ilyich had lived a productive, upwardly mobile life. Tolstoy tells us he was capable, cheerful, good-natured and sociable, though strict in the fulfillment of what he considered to be his duty. And he considered his duty to be what was so considered by those in authority. In other words, he was a successful product of the moral ecology and social status system of his time. He had a good job and a fine reputation. His marriage was cold, but he spent less time with his family and regarded this as normal. Ilyich tries to go back to his former way of thinking, but the onrushing presence of death thrusts new thoughts into his head. He thinks back on his childhood with special fondness, but the more he thinks about his adulthood, the less satisfactory it seems. He had rushed into marriage almost as an accident. He had been preoccupied with money year after year. His career triumphs now seem trivial. "Maybe I did not live as I ought to have done?" he suddenly asks himself. The whole story plays with notions of up and down. The higher he goes externally, the farther he sinks internally. He begins to experience the life he had led as a stone falling downward with increasing velocity. It occurs to him that he had felt small, scarcely noticeable impulses to struggle against what was thought good and proper by society. But he had not really attended to them. He now realizes that his professional duties and the whole arrangement of his life and of his family and all his social and official interests might all have been false. He tried to defend those things to himself and suddenly felt the weakness of what he was defending. There was nothing to defend. Tolstoy probably goes overboard in renouncing Ivan's Adam One life. It had not all been false and worthless, but he starkly paints the portrait of a man without an inner world until the occasion of his death. In those final hours, the man finally gets a glimpse of what he should have known all along. He fell through the hole, and there at the bottom was a light. At that very moment, Ivan Ilyich fell through and caught sight of the light, and it was revealed to him that though his life had not been what it should have been, this could still be rectified. He asked himself, "What is the right thing?" and grew still, listening. Many of us are in Ivan Ilyich's position, recognizing that the social system we are part of pushes us to live out one sort of insufficient external life. But we have what Ilyich did not have, time to rectify it. The question is how. The answer must be to stand against, at least in part, the prevailing winds of culture. The answer must be to join a counterculture. To live a decent life, to build up the soul, it's probably necessary to declare that the forces that encourage the big me, while necessary and liberating in many ways, have gone too far. We are out of balance. It's probably necessary to have one foot in the world of achievement, but another foot in a counterculture that is in tension with the achievement ethos. It's probably necessary to reassert a balance between Adam One and Adam Two, and to understand that if anything, Adam Two is more important than Adam One. The Humility Code. Each society creates its own moral ecology. A moral ecology is a set of norms, assumptions, beliefs, and habits of behavior, and an institutionalized set of moral demands that emerge organically. Our moral ecology encourages us to be a certain sort of person. When you behave consistently with your society's moral ecology, people smile at you, and you are encouraged to continue acting in that way. The moral ecology of a given moment is never unanimous. There are always rebels, critics, and outsiders. But each moral climate is a collective response to the problems of the moment, and it shapes the people who live within it. Over the past several decades, we have built a moral ecology around the big me, around the belief in a golden figure inside. This has led to a rise in narcissism and self-aggrandizement. This has encouraged us to focus on the external Adam One side of our natures and ignore the inner world of Adam Two. To restore the balance, to rediscover Adam Two, to cultivate the eulogy virtues, it's probably necessary to revive and follow what we accidentally left behind, the counter-tradition of moral realism, or what I've been calling the crooked timber school. It's probably necessary to build a moral ecology based on the ideas of this school, to follow its answers to the most important questions. Toward what should I orient my life? Who am I, and what is my nature? How do I mold my nature to make it gradually better day by day? What virtues are the most important to cultivate, and what weaknesses should I fear the most? How can I raise my children with a true sense of who they are and a practical set of ideas about how to travel the long road to character? So far, the propositions that define the crooked timber tradition have been scattered across the many chapters that make up this book. I thought it might be useful to draw them together and recapitulate them here in one list, even if presenting them in numbered list form does tend to simplify them and make them seem cruder than they are. Together, these propositions form a humility code, a coherent image of what to live for and how to live. These are the general propositions that form this humility code. 1. We don't live for happiness, we live for holiness. Day to day we seek out pleasure, but deep down human beings are endowed with moral imagination. All human beings seek to lead lives not just of pleasure, but of purpose, righteousness, and virtue. As John Stuart Mill put it, people have a responsibility to become more moral over time. The best life is oriented around the increasing excellence of the soul and is nourished by moral joy, the quiet sense of gratitude and tranquility that comes as a byproduct of successful moral struggle. The meaningful life is the same eternal thing, the combination of some set of ideals and some man or woman's struggle for those ideals. Life is essentially a moral drama, not a hedonistic one. 2. Proposition 1 defines the goal of life. The long road to character begins with an accurate understanding of our nature, and the core of that understanding is that we are flawed creatures. We have an innate tendency toward selfishness and overconfidence. We have a tendency to see ourselves as the center of the universe, as if everything revolves around us. We resolve to do one thing but end up doing the opposite. We know what is deep and important in life, but we still pursue the things that are shallow and vain. Furthermore, we overestimate our own strength and rationalize our own failures. We know less than we think we do. We give in to short-term desires even when we know we shouldn't. We imagine that spiritual and moral needs can be solved through status and material things. 3. Although we are flawed creatures, we are also splendidly endowed. We are divided within ourselves, both fearfully and wonderfully made. We do sin, but we also have the capacity to recognize sin, to feel ashamed of sin, and to overcome sin. We are both weak and strong, bound and free, blind and far-seeing. We thus have the capacity to struggle with ourselves. There is something heroic about a person in struggle with herself, strained on the rack of conscience, suffering torments, yet staying alive and growing stronger, sacrificing a worldly success for the sake of an inner victory. 4. In the struggle against your own weakness, humility is the greatest virtue. Humility is having an accurate assessment of your own nature and your own place in the cosmos. Humility is awareness that you are an underdog in the struggle against your own weakness. Humility is an awareness that your individual talents alone are inadequate to the tasks that have been assigned to you. Humility reminds you that you are not the center of the universe, but you serve a larger order. 5. Pride is the central vice. Pride is a problem in the sensory apparatus. Pride blinds us to the reality of our divided nature. Pride blinds us to our own weaknesses and misleads us into thinking we are better than we are. Pride makes us more certain and closed-minded than we should be. Pride makes it hard for us to be vulnerable before those whose love we need. Pride makes cold-heartedness and cruelty possible. Because of pride, we try to prove we are better than those around us. Pride deludes us into thinking that we are the authors of our own lives. 6. Once the necessities for survival are satisfied, the struggle against sin and for virtue is the central drama of life. No external conflict is as consequential or as dramatic as the inner campaign against our own deficiencies. This struggle against, say, selfishness or prejudice or insecurity gives meaning and shape to life. It is more important than the external journey up the ladder of success. This struggle against sin is the great challenge, so that life is not futile or absurd. It is possible to fight this battle well or badly, humorlessly or with cheerful spirit. Contending with weakness often means choosing what parts of yourself to develop and what parts not to develop. The purpose of the struggle against sin and weakness is not to win, because that is not possible. It is to get better at waging it. It doesn't matter if you work at a hedge fund or a charity serving the poor. There are heroes and schmucks in both worlds. The most important thing is whether you are willing to engage in this struggle. 7. Character is built in the course of your inner confrontation. Character is a set of dispositions, desires, and habits that are slowly engraved during the struggle against your own weakness. You become more disciplined, considerate, and loving through 1,000 small acts of self-control, sharing, service, friendship, and refined enjoyment. If you make disciplined, caring choices, you are slowly engraving certain tendencies into your mind.